Hi everyone, I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Tracy for extending the privilege to come out and share with you tonight, and Mark for approving it. And, so he heard me say do 10 minutes about a month and a half ago or so ago, and he thought that was, you know, enough of an interview that I got, so, or audition, you know, depending on how you want to look at it, you know. But I'm glad to be here either way. And I'm married to him, and he comes up here every year. I don't. I come up every once. I came up once, and so anyways, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a gift, and I often am a hard person to give a gift to. I'm never happy with any of the gifts that I've been given, so I often turn them in, and I did that with my sobriety too. So my sobriety date is January 9th of 2009, and it's not my first sobriety date, and but it's the longest one I've had so far, so we'll hopefully keep going. And you know, I love to drink. I love what alcohol does to me, and I also I love to smoke weed, especially when I was a kid. Weed was really good. Weed is the type of thing that you could just go to the guy who lives in the alley and get, you know. It was just so easy. You got $5, you get a little nickel bag, you know. And I'm a fancy weed smoker. Actually, I'm not. The fancy weed smokers now are the ones that use those Swiffers that you can, you know, smell like great weed for like 6 miles away, you know. And every time I smell that sweet weed, I always think of my son, you know, because that's what he would do. And then I would find, I'm going off topic here, but then I would find, like, you know, the tobacco all over the bathroom, you know, because he would, like, you know, get rid of it. But anyways, love to be a parent. But I mean, who am I going to say anything? I mean, God, if he only knew half the crap that I did. I mean, his favorite thing was, "Mom, you don't know." Actually, he would say, "Mom, you don't effing know." And we actually were going to put that on his tombstone. "You don't effing know." And because we heard it so often. And, you know, but what he doesn't realize in my generation, I'm 55 years old, and in my generation, everything that they, security reasons why they do now, is because of me, you know? And, but he doesn't get that. So anyways, so there I am. I'm in the alley. I'm getting my little nickel bag. And it's just so easy when you're young, you know? I was just a kid. And, I was talking about weed smoking. And I'm the girl that would, my dad would always, couldn't figure out why there was no the cardboard toilet paper ring in the toilet, in the paper, toilet paper, because I would, like, unroll it out and, you know, cut a little hole and get some tin foil and put a little holes in there, and that was my bomb, you know. And and if you haven't noticed, I've drinking the bong water once too many times, so, you know. But anyways, and so when you're, you know, when you're 11, 12 years old, weed is so much easier. To be an alcoholic, or to drink, that was a lot of work. We had to steal it, whether from the store or your parents, and or we had to pimp it, you know. And I'm from the days of pimping where, you know, you just find the creepy, gross-looking guy, bum, to go, you know, to get, buy us our weed, or, I mean, to get us our alcohol. So it was a lot of work, you know. And But I did it, you know, because I love the effect produced by alcohol. Even at that very little young age, when I started drinking, and I always knew that I was different, you know. But I didn't know there was a word for it, you know. Back in my day, it felt like I was weird. I felt stupid. I hate to say this, but I am. I'm like the graduate of special ed programs, you know. I've never been in the principal's office with my dad with the, you know, principal saying, but she has such potential. I am not the potential girl. You know, I started low and I stayed low. And which is, you know, great because, you know, I have, you know, I don't have a lot of high expectations on people or anything. And and I'm drinking, and this is, I didn't say that. And I, this was back in like 1978, 79, in Orange County, South Orange County. I grew up in Costa Mesa, went to Newport Harbor High, and when you're scrawny and skinny and dark haired, going to a Newport Harbor High, and all the, to me, all the girls looked like they were blonde haired and blue eyed, and I just hated them, you know. I just felt so inferior to them, and through many years of doing, you know, inventory and stuff, the only reason why I hated them was one reason only, is because I tried out for the cheerleading team and I didn't get on it, you know. I'm one of those people, I don't just like dislike you, I hate you. And I want to kill you and you're dead, you know. And I'm 55 years old, and many, many times I still get into, I hate you, I want to kill you, you're dead. You know, I close it off. And so I had to do inventory. And I kept looking at the blonde girl, but the one she's like, when I grew up, we hated the girls with the dark hair and the brown eyes and the scrawny little girl. Just kidding. So this is back in 1978-79, and this is going to kill somebody. And you did, almost killed you. You're dead. And, so 1978-79, the best thing happened in South Orange County, and a whole new revolution happened, and that was the punk scene. And I fitted right in, you know. I dyed my hair black, I frizzed it all up, I put my black eyeliner on, and I look like that, like I do today, and not much has changed, except I do take a little more personal hygienes, and I have more personal hygienes. And so, and what I loved about it is that they looked exactly like on the outside what I felt like on the inside. You know, they just looked all, you know, pinned together. And that's how I've always felt on the inside, just pinned together. And I love the anger, I love the violence, I love all of that. But at the same time, you know, I'm singing my disco songs and going to the, you know, roller rink and being the disco queen there, you know, and then I get home and I'd meet up with my friends and we'd go to, you know, the gigs that are going around town. And there was this one place, a little concert hall called the Cuckoo's Nest in Costa Mesa. And a lot of bands would go there and play and rehearse. And I just loved that anger. And what most importantly, what I loved about it is I think I loved the fear of what it brought to people, you know, normal people. You know, I love the fear of what it brought to somebody, you know, and because I felt a lot of power in that. Now, I'm like 12 years old, and I've already, you know, established power, power or fear means power, you know, and so, you know, and I'm young and I've already noticed this, you know, and I'm that type of girl that, you know, my dad was a single father and he raised my brother and I by himself most of the time. And, you know, and I put that man through hell, you know, and he was always so scared for me and what was going on. And, you know, by the time I was 14 years old, doing what I'm doing, you know, going to school, not going to school. And he is one of those people where, you know, this is long before, you know, the neighborhood watch established or anything like that. But he figured out that our little pot dealer lived three doors down in the alley. And so him and our neighbors would go sit across the street from him in you know, lounge chairs with guns and just stay across the street from him. And then he eventually moved, you know. And but this is the same man who saw Red Dawn and then went to the school board and said that we needed to do some type of prepping for our children. So, you know, and he's no better now, you know, but he's still looking for Bigfoot. But so anyways, and so, you know, by the time I'm 14, I you know, I've got this ratted up hair, you know, I'm hanging out with these people who I shouldn't have been hanging out with. I'm constantly going up to LA, I'm hitchhiking up there, and you know, and I've got this, you know, Bozo the Clown makeup on, white face, black, you know, black eyes, black lips, and black hair, and I you know, and I looked like a skunk, you know. I smelled like one. I looked like one. I just didn't have all that hygiene in the world. And my friends used to call me Pepe Le Pew, you know. And that's just what I looked like, you know, just a little skunk and a little rodent. And so I was 14 years old. This is 1983, and you know, and it was a big movement of adolescent recovery. And and all my dad wanted was me. He just wanted his daughter back, you know. He just wanted his little girl. And what he did is he put me into treatment at 1983. I was 14, and you know, I turned 15 in there, and you know, and I just didn't get it. You know, I didn't understand what you guys. I was, you know, 14, 15 years old, and I didn't understand what you guys were talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm in this treatment center. It's an 8 to 12 week long treatment center, and I'm in there for, you know, 5.5 months, and I never got out of pajamas more than, you know, a week or two, because and I'm an AWOL risk, you know. As soon as they give me clothes, I am out the door, you know. And I always ended up at the same place, which was the 7-Eleven liquor store or 7-Eleven store at the payphone, because I have one friend, and I'm gonna call that friend. And they would always get me right there at the payphone before I can even, you know, make a call. And before, they used to chase me down in the, you know, down the halls in the hospital. And then what I did, and then towards the end, they would just, you know, meet me at the payphone, and they'd always get there first. And what happened was is that I didn't realize while I was, you know, running down the hall, you know, making a left, making another left, going through the double doors, going left to go to the 7-Eleven payphone, they were just going straight down the alley, and they would just kind of cut me off. And so finally, they sat me down in the treatment center, and they put me in this room. And now I'm sure there may have just been a couple people in there at a table, but to me it seemed like the table, you know, the round table of the nights. You know, it just seemed like they had all these people, counselors, doctors, and everybody, and it just seemed like they just went around the table one by one by one by one. You know, Shannon, we're not quite sure we know what to do with you. You know, you've been here for 5.5 months, and you just don't seem to get it. Next one. Shannon, we've given you all the tools for you to stay sober, and now it's time for you to take those tools out and work them. And then they go to the next person. And as they're talking, I'm thinking to myself, tools. I didn't get any tools. That's my problem. I have no tools. They're talking about tools to live by, the tools of the program. I'm thinking hammers, screwdrivers, bolts. At 15, I have no clue what they're talking about. At 15, I don't understand incomprehensible demoralization. At 15, I don't understand the true meaning of alcoholism. I don't hear the language of the heart. I don't understand it, you know? It says that for the young potential young alcoholic should not drink because most likely they will surely become an alcoholic. Potential means one day, someday, soon, not quite yet, you know? But knowing that now, but not knowing it then, did not mean I wasn't going to run around these wonderful meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and all I did was create chaos, you know? I was that your typical young person in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was rude, I was disrespectful. Back then we didn't say sit down, stay seated, don't get up during the meeting, you know? We were just bopping around, you know? I traded high school for young people's Alcoholics Anonymous. This became my high school, you know? It was about where the dance was, what we're gonna do, all that stuff. I am one of those people where we go to Coco's after a meeting and we would stay there God knows how long, drink coffee all night long, scream, yell, be obnoxious. And, you know, coffee then was, what, maybe 55 cents? I popped down my big 60 cents after 18 hours of being in there drinking, you know, 46 cups of coffee. And then the good people, the nice people, the people who have tools, come to the Coco's the next day, and they nicely say, we're sorry, we don't want people from Alcoholics Anonymous here. You know, not because of your actions, because of my actions. And that's what, sadly, that is what the version of the big book that those people saw, you know. When I got out of a treatment center, the one thing that center did tell me to do was to get a sponsor, and I had gotten this lady, and Kim H., I'll never forget her name, and she would, when I called her and I said, well, I graduated treatment. I thought I graduated. They just let me go. I didn't even know, you know. Graduated sounded like I was more of prestige. And, and she said, that's great. I'll come pick you up. And I remember my disappointment when I got home. You know, I hadn't been home in 5.5 months. I had belittled my father while I was in treatment to the point where they had to tell my father to stop coming to visit me because he knew I would be able to belittle him enough to take me out of treatment, you know, and they just wanted me to get it, you know. I've had so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous just try to spoon feed me Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just couldn't get it, you know, and so she came and she picked me up in Costa Mesa. And she took me to a meeting in Tustin, and she'd take me back home to Costa Mesa, and then she would go home in Anaheim Hills, and she'd get up in the morning, go to work, and then she'd come drive to Costa Mesa, she'd pick me up, she'd take me to a meeting in Tustin, she would take me back home, and then she would drive home to Anaheim Hills, wake up the next morning, go to work, and then come pick me up in Costa Mesa and take me to a meeting and take me back to Costa Mesa, and then she would drive back home to Anaheim Hills. And this woman did this for the better part, probably for a year or so. And she was just trying to work the steps with me. She was just trying to spoon feed me Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't remember working any of the steps with her. I'm sure she worked all 12 of them about me, you know, and with her sponsor, you know. But this woman, she did that. And it took me many, many years to come to the realization what the sacrifice she had done just for that one suffering alcoholic who just couldn't get it. She wanted me to get this program so desperately. And I don't know if it was my age. I don't know if it was my potential. I didn't know any of that, you know. But, you know, what happened is that somehow, some way, I ended up in the Big Book group in Bellflower. And I'd gotten another. She had moved away. And I didn't have a sponsor for a few years, which is okay because, you know what? I wasn't working the steps anyways, you know. So I got this lady as my sponsor. And once again, she's trying to spoon feed me Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And my life is a mess. The version of the Big Book that I had outside of these meetings was nothing what my dad wanted. You know, he wanted his princess back, and he got nothing but just chaos. You know, living, breathing chaos, and you know, I'm sober a few years. I'm living at home, and my dad kicks me out, you know, because he can't handle the way I'm behaving sober. I was probably far, far better drunk and stoned, okay? And at least I was a little more manageable. But sober, I wasn't so manageable. And I ended up having to move in with, I don't tell this story often, but I had to move in with, my sponsor at the time was Debbie Harris, and she was married to Johnny, and they moved me into their house, okay? Because again, I have had wonderful people try to spoon feed me Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there was this something about me that I guess some people just want to, they just want me to live, you know? And they're just, you know, they're helping me out, and they're, you know, my only job there is to walk the dogs, you know? And so I would walk their dogs, I would run their dogs, really, because I was young. I was like 18 years old, 19. Were we engaged then? No? Maybe? I don't know. But I would run their dogs. Like, they had these two little shit chews, and that's about as close as I can get to cussing at a podium. And I would just run them, and I remember after I moved out, Johnny Guy was mad because every time he would try to go walk their dogs, they'd want to run, you know? But they were just trying to spoon feed me Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what happened is, I stayed sober. I started working the steps to the best of my abilities, you know? I met Ron, and we got married, and we moved into our own little apartment, you know, and we started having kids, what happened is that he got drunk, and I got drunk, and he made me drink, and like he said, we were going to spend the next 2.5 years in a living hell, you know. And what happened to me is that the promises started coming true. And it's not the promises that we read, or we do read, but there's so many promises in Alcoholics Anonymous in that book that we forget to talk about, you know. The promises of in prison, insanity, and death. Those promises is when we drink. When resentments cut us off from the spirit of the light. And the only thing that we alcoholics can do is drink. you know, and that's what was happening, you know. I was sitting in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was angry. I was bitter. I was resentful. I radiated hate. I looked like hate, and I hated everybody and everything. And God, if you were like 60 days sober and you got up there and you started talking about how great your new job was and you just got this big promotion and a, you know, brand new, you're driving a brand new Mercedes out, and I'd be sitting there with like, you know, 9.5 years going, what? I just wrote a bad check for my rent, you know, now I gotta walk around the back and hope the lights turn on, but I can't really turn them on because we can't let the landlords know that we're home, and you know, and I've got, and I'm 9.5 years sober, you know, and I'm still writing bad checks, and it's not my fault, you know. they gave me a checkbook, you know, and I mean, I write checks with no checking account. Like, just because I have a checkbook doesn't mean I have a checking account, you know. And my favorite is, remember in the days when you can go to the liquor store and write a check, and they cash it, and then you know you hurry up and you try to give them cash. Sorry, I didn't know it bounced, right? Our liquor store, JJ's liquor store, was not only our bank, the bank of JJ, because that's where we would take our paycheck and get it cash, because that's where good standing, outstanding citizens like me do our banking, is at the liquor store. And then they would take, you know, however much. We can even, you know, back then we'd pay like your gas, electric, and phone bill at the liquor store. And you know, we would do that, or we were supposed to pay our bills, but we didn't. And JJ's would, you know, take our paycheck, and then they would keep like half of it because they given us consignment the entire week, you know. And that's where I went my grocery store shopping for my kids and got my, you know, formula and my diapers and all that for them, because that's what good mothers do, you know. And I'm one of those, where I was talking, reminiscing about the days when, you know, we'd go to do laundry, you know, and like, you know, shove, you know, six loads in one load. And this back, they had liquid that was so expensive, but we had to use that powder. And so you do the laundry and you take your laundry out and you still have all the white marks across it from the water not really getting in there and penetrating. But I even took it one step further. I would get rubber gloves, and you put oil on them, and then you put your quarters in them, and you stick them in, and you get your quarters back, you know? I did a lot of laundry that way. But anyways, that's how I live, you know, when I'm drinking. You know, I love my children, but they can't keep me sober. By this time, I now have two children. One of my sons, Connor, he's one of those kids who needs a little bit of special treatment. He had severe asthma, and we used to have him get, you know, breathing treatments. And so, you know, I'd have to give him these breathing treatments, you know, 2-3 times a day. And we can't even keep the electricity on. You know, because I have to make a decision. Do I pay my electric bill so my son can breathe and live, or do I drink? And it doesn't mean I don't love my son. It just means that alcohol is going to win no matter what. There's no decisions to be made. And we have neighbors. We have kind neighbors, you know, who allowed us to, you know, use extension cords to give our son breathing treatment. My husband, he's not an electrician or a cable man, but somehow he was able to spike the line. And we had cable, you know? That was back in the day where you were able to spike the cable wires, you know? Those are good days. You know, we don't get that anymore. But now he has to work for everything we have. So Anyways, you know, and this is how I'm living my life, you know, and I just didn't know that alcohol was going to do that to me, you know. I didn't know the stories that you told at these podiums, I was going to start living them. I just didn't know that. I didn't think that was going to happen. As like every alcoholic cry, my case is different. You know, I always thought my case was different. And, you know, and one day I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, I looked at that, my child's red face, you know, that I would come to and after their nap, and sometimes I wouldn't wake up before their naps, and I wake up while they're crying, and I look at their face and try to determine how long they've been crying by how red and swollen their face was. You know, that cherry picking face that, you know, they get when they cry for so long, and that little tomato face, you know, and one day I was just tired of it. I just couldn't do it anymore. And so I called Johnny, and for some reason I still remember. That's one thing, you know, old-timers will do a lot of things, you know. They'll get married, divorce. In Johnny's case, get married, divorce, 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 you know. But I still remembered his number. And I had called him, and he says, you know where I'm going to be. Why don't you pack your trash up and come to the meeting? And he had sent some people over, and he sent people that didn't even like, you know, I didn't like them. They were like people from my past life. That's, you know, when you're sober before, they become your past life, you know. They were my past sobriety life, and I hated them. And you know, but I'm going to tell you something, they were so kind to me, they were so caring to me. And I think if they weren't kind that day, And believe me, one of the gentlemen's a total jerk, but he's kind now. But, you know, if he wasn't kind to me that day, you'd have a different speaker, because I just needed one person on my side that one very moment. Just one person. And, you know, and I started going to, you know, the Pacific Group, because I didn't want to go back to Bellflower, because I was just afraid that I didn't want them to judge me. You know, and I went back to the Pacific Group, and I acted like I had like 6 years, or I mean 6 months of sobriety, because, you know, I figured that would seem a lot better than being, you know, day one. You know, in my case, it was like 3 hours, but, you know, I don't know where my thinking was logically. You know, when we're new, we don't have any logical thinking anyways, you know. We think it's logic, you know, and the best part is everybody knows, you know, and who to know. And so, you know, I got this lady, Brenda W, you know, and she's a kind, loving, wonderful lady today. And, but sadly, I wanted her as my own sponsor. My husband got a hold of her phone number, and then next thing you know, it just seemed like she was sponsoring us both, you know, he ratted me out is what he did, you know. And, you know, I remember when she's like, well, I talked to Ron. And I remember my husband was in there, and I was like on the phone flipping him off, you know, as he's walking by, you know. And, you know, and we've been married, what, 34 years? But, oh, you know, I remember he wasn't even, I made him sleep on the couch for a long time when we first got sober, because, and it was like he's 6'5", and it was like a love seat, like a love couch, you know, one of those like small ones. But I was too busy with my kids in the bed and just trying to, you know, and God, we're such white trash. We had a water bed, but with a regular mattress in it, you know, yeah. Real fancy. We had the frame. We had a waterbed frame. And I remember one time I went to go do laundry the beddings, and I lifted it up to, you know, make the bed, and there was like 1,000 cockroaches in between the frame and the bed. What? Cockroach story, you know? God sakes, we're in Lancaster. They're all getting squirmish. There's a parade of them going down the street right now, but anyways,
I was talking to a gentleman. He goes, yeah, I've been out here about 17 years. I chased a girl out here. And I'm like, yeah, I'm crack, you know. But anyways, and so that was me. Anyways, so I got a few more minutes. I got to get going. And so I got sober again, and I started going to Pacific Group because I was too afraid to be new in the group that, you know, raised me. And so what happened is eventually, which kind of worked out good because my husband got sober again, and he was going, you know, we first started out in the Pacific Group, then he started going back to Bellflower. And I got a little mad because that was like my home group before, and it was like, you know, I was being territorial, you know, for meetings and stuff. I mean, my own husband, like, you can't go there, you know. But anyways, you know, but it kind of worked out in the first 5 years because the meetings that I went to, he stayed home with the kids, and then the meetings that he went to, I stayed home with the kids. It just seemed to work out perfectly like that, you know. God couldn't give us any better solution, you know. And and I love meetings with daycare, you know. We went to the Saturday night meeting for many years, and they had daycare there. And, you know, they started out with a daycare like that, you know, but my kids would cry, my Connor would cry so long and loud and disturb the meeting. Everybody could hear him, you know. And it wasn't like, you know, for like the first few minutes. It was like 45 minutes long, you know. But they let us stay in these meetings because they knew that we needed these meetings. And they just kept moving the daycare back until they found another room. And but they let us stay in these meetings. And, you know, and then... you know, and so what happened is that, you know, unbeknownst to us, we started bringing Alcoholics Anonymous in our own home, you know, and he would come home from a meeting, he would say, you know, tell me about the meetings, you know, who's doing what, who spoke, who's doing who, you know, we talk about that. And then I would come home and, you know, I'd say, you know, who's doing what, who spoke, who's doing who, you know, and we just started bringing Alcoholics Anonymous into our own home for the first time. And, you know, but... when I was 13 and a half years sober, you know, I thought my life was really good, you know, and at least I thought it was. And we had money for like the first time in a real long time, and I thought maybe if I gambled a little, we could have more money. And so now I'm also in GA, and I can't even count without using my fingers, you know what I mean? I need a calculator, and hell, I can barely speak. But, you know, and so what happened is I got to a point in my life where it just seemed like I didn't realize that, you know, that money could be a very spiritual thing as long as you don't make it your God, you know? And I also didn't realize the sanity. My sanity often was based upon what was in my checking account, you know. And so, you know, what happened is I got to this point right back to where I was before. I was angry, I was bitter, I radiated hate, and I was uncomfortable, and I wanted to drink. And I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm afraid to tell you that I want to drink. Because I thought at 15 and a half years of sobriety, I shouldn't feel that way. I shouldn't be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and want to drink. I mean, we're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why would I want to drink, right? But that's where I was, and I was just full of fear. And another thing is that I desperately wanted to tell you, but I desperately didn't want to work the steps again. You know what I mean? And I mean, that seems too easy. And so what happened is I got to this jumping off point, you know, I got to the jumping off point to where I just wanted to die. And it talks about that, and that's a really scary place to be, you know. And so what happened is at 13 and a half years, I started drinking again, you know. And once again, those promises were going to come right back to me, you know, the insanity, the prison, and then death. And I came back in 2009, and I wasn't out very long, but it was long enough, and it was hard. And at 40, it wasn't cute anymore, you know. And so I got sober again, and I saw the power, the miracle of a home group, and how they They came into my life and into my family's life, you know, and I was like broken spun glass. And I watched this group take their AA super glue, and they started gluing the little pieces of our lives back together, my life. And then, no, it wasn't just my life, it was my family's life, it was my husband's life. They started slowly bringing and putting us back together, one little piece at a time, you know. And I had a beautiful sponsor, her name's Patty Ochoa. And she would laugh. God, I would come to her with all these problems. She would be like, the worse it was, the funnier she thought it was, you know. And she taught me the power of prayer. And then she died when I was just a little over 10 years sober. And then I have another sponsor. Her name's Virginia. And she is, you know, she is also about the power of prayer, you know. And I'm not, you know, my prayer is, you know, I hate you, you know, I kill you, you're dead. And it's been a whole, like, you know, and then once again, you know, three years ago, we got that phone call, and, you know, we got the phone call from the morgue asking us what we should do with our son. And I was like, what? You know, and that's how we found out my son was killed in a car accident. And, you know, and once again, that power of that home group is right there again with their magical AA super glue, you know. And the same thing happened again a few months ago or a year ago. And, you know, they were right there in our lives and going through all these treatments with us, constantly asking us how we're doing, constantly. Because if they get in my face, how are you doing, Shem? How are you doing? I'll be like, what? You know, I'm doing fine, you know? And they care. I'm joking, you know, but they really care. But at the same time, I'm like, you know me. Don't get in my face. You know what I mean? It's like, but they cared enough to do that, you know? And they just kept bugging me. They didn't care. You know, and we did all that. And we had a beautiful miracle, you know, come out of that. My husband's still alive, you know? That youngest son that needed that breathing treatment, you know, he's a man boy living at home still. He's 31, you know, and he's a professor, you know. Come on, he's got a man professor beard, you know. But kids, they just do things different, you know. And come on, go write some bad checks. But I'm so glad to be here. And again, I thank you for my sobriety.